Well, thank you, Tripp, and thank you for this great opportunity for me to be with you today. I have been so excited when Tripp contacted me a little bit over a year ago about coming to be with you. I was so excited about it and have looked forward to it ever since. I have this church, and I'll say more of this about this upstairs, but this church has been an integral part of who I am, and you, not just the time that I spent here, but in the years that have followed. I have been so repeatedly really blessed by all that you meant to me during this time and continue to mean that to me. I'll say this probably again upstairs, but I carry a bit of Auburn and Auburn University and especially AFBC with me every day. And so I really, really appreciate all of you and all that you've meant to me. I did want to mention that I'm honored by my family was not able to come. Each of our sons have various responsibilities, both work-wise and church-wise, that they're involved in. And I wanted Robbie, my wife, to be able to come, but she is a preschool teacher at our church in Sunday school, and we're about to celebrate our 30th anniversary in a short time, and we're going to be taking a trip out of state and to the Shenandoah Valley and staying up there for a week, and we're going to be gone two Sundays. And she said, I would love to go to Auburn, but I can't leave my kids 3 weeks so close together. So that's why she's not here. But again, I'm extremely grateful for this opportunity. I especially am honored that these lectures are in honor and memory of Claude Moore. Claude was the chairman of deacons, actually, when I was the youth minister here, and was always very supportive of me and my ministry, and remember him very fondly. He was a great encourager for me. And of course, you know this better than I do, but I consider Mary Virginia Moore one of the grand ladies in all of Christendom. And so, and yes, applause is appropriate here. I said last night at her house that I have a collection of letters of encouragement that Mary Virginia has sent to me over the years. And sometimes when I need a word of encouragement, I will pull one of those out and draw encouragement from it. So thank you, Mary Virginia. On the afternoon of All Hallows Eve, October 31st, 1517, an obscure German monk nailed what would become a world-changing document to the door of the Wittenberg Church, essentially designed to stimulate an academic debate of the abuses of the indulgence system. This seemingly murky moment initiated one of the pivotal events in world history. No one could have expected that in a few years, the Western Church would split and then fracture into many splinters, a fracturing and splintering that continues even into this day. Likewise, no one could have imagined that this momentous split would contribute to other world-changing events that linger and resonate 500 years later. Imagine for a minute, if you will, a massive river, perhaps the muddy Mississippi, the mighty Amazon, the persistent Nile, or the determined Yangtze. It begins in the mountains or in the plains with runoff from a huge rainstorm or from melting snow or ice in the mountains. It's fed by tributaries, large and small, as it makes its way to the sea. Along the way, it brushes against deserts and mountains and runs through jungles and plains. At times, it is hindered by the geography. At other times, the natural features of the land help it. Sometimes, it rushes violently and floods beyond its banks, wreaking havoc as it goes, damaging and destroying with a force unlike few things known in nature. At other times, it slows to a muddy crawl, depositing soil that it has ripped away farther upstream, enriching the lands that it touches, and often cleansing them of contamination or stagnation. As it nears the ocean, it deposits further this rich alluvial soil along a vast delta that builds and fertilizes land in direct contrast to the way that it has destroyed land hundreds, even thousands of miles away. Finally, it reaches the ocean and mixes with what began as fresh water or snowfall with the briny salinity of water that connects with the other oceans of the world. This mighty river illustrates the Reformation. Like a mighty river, the Reformation did not begin in a single spot. Although Martin Luther, most deservedly, often is given credit. At times, admittedly, it too has created havoc and wreaked destruction. At far more times, it has built and enriched the people and the lands that it has touched. It has created rich theological and spiritual deltas in which powerful ideas, churches, denominations, and deep spirituality have taken root. Likewise, it has deposited its waters into oceans that reach literally around the world. Though Christianity acknowledges 500 years of Reformation history this year, and we could easily direct our attention to that rich and varied history, we will focus today, this morning at least, rather upon one of the great deposits of the Reformation River that enriched the deltas of Protestant Christianity and continues to spread its influence around the oceans of the world. That rich deposit of Baptist heritage that emerged from the Reformation and prepared the soil for the Free Church movement in church and Christian history continues to enrich Christian life today. At this point, it's important for us to note that much of Baptist history that will be recalled this morning was not and is not exclusive to Baptist heritage alone. Certainly, as will be shown, elements of that heritage have antecedents and parallels in church history. Baptists are indebted to those who have gone before, no matter who these Christians were, what their faults as human beings, and what their denominational affiliation. However, this presentation seeks to demonstrate for us areas in which Baptists have either led the way or provided unique contributions or emphases to themes, distinctives, and outcomes that have both benefited the Christian church specifically and U.S. and world history on a broader scope. We must be careful, however, that in lauding our Baptist heritage, we do not slip into Baptist exceptionalism. At the same time, we should acknowledge, however, that as Keith Harper says, history helps make sense of confusing situations and lends clarity to values when people lose confidence in authority figures. Now, contrary to the attitudes of some, God did not say on the eighth day, "Let there be Baptist." Likewise, contrary to the beliefs of some, Baptists did not begin with John the Baptist, the Jordan River, and Jerusalem. Jesus' disciples did not organize the First Baptist Church of Jerusalem, nor were Paul's epistles addressed to Baptist churches of Ephesus, Corinth, and Philippi. On the other hand, the first identifiable Baptist churches to emerge in the 17th century did not suddenly and miraculously appear. Rather, the emergence of Baptist churches related directly to a resurfacing of the New Testament concept of believers' baptism in the voluntary church that the organized Christian church had submerged during the centuries between the New Testament and the Protestant Reformation in Western Europe. During those centuries, the Roman Catholic Church developed as the dominant institution in education, government, economic, social, cultural, and even military life after the fall of the Roman Empire. While believers' baptism still occurred, when Christianity penetrated pagan areas, infant baptism became the norm, and the parish church became the religious center of the European communities. In the early 16th century, however, reformers like Martin Luther, Ulrich Zwingli, Thomas Cranmer, and John Calvin challenged the long-held assumptions of the Roman Catholic Church. Emphasizing the authority of the Bible, these reformers also stressed the importance of salvation by faith through grace rather than by the rituals and works-related salvation that the medieval church appeared to emphasize. As the Reformation spread in Europe, another group of reformers who came to be known as the Anabaptists emerged. Notable because of their insistence upon believers' baptism, these radical reformers urged Christians to jettison infant baptism and return to the New Testament definition of voluntary faith and church membership that could only be achieved through believers' baptism. While there is no documented direct tie between these Anabaptists on the European continent and the first identifiable English Baptist, there was great similarity but also significant dissimilarity between the beliefs of these continental Anabaptists and the first English Baptist. Many of these Anabaptists who survived the intense persecution enacted by both Protestants and Roman Catholics eventually evolved into Christians now identified as Mennonites. As the English Reformation took place, the shape of the Anglican Church remained similar to that of the Roman Catholic Church. Significant numbers of English Christians called Puritans sought to purify the Anglican Church of remnants of Roman Catholicism. Increasingly, though, others believed that the English Church could not be purified and urged true Christians to separate completely from the Anglican Church and restore the Church as it existed in the New Testament. These dissenters came to be known as separatists, and the English government heavily persecuted them so much that many of these English separatists fled to the Dutch Netherlands. Out of these separatist refugees emerged the first Baptist. Like those Christians who had gone before them in the centuries before the Reformation, and like those who blazed a path during and after the Reformation, these Baptist Christians made their own deposits in Christian heritage. As we focus on these deposits of Baptist heritage within the history of the church, we will recall this morning heroes and stories of the past, and we will build on those hero stories around four general contributions of Baptists throughout more than 400 years of Baptist heritage. These four categories will be freedom of conscience, religious freedom, missions, evangelism, missions, evangelism, preaching, education and theology, social justice, ethics, and pastoral ministry. As we briefly recount a few Baptist heroes and their stories today as representative of the contributions of Baptist Christianity, we do well to heed the words of Lee Bowman and Terence Deal, who in discussing the importance of symbolism write, exploits of heroes are lodged in our psyches. We call on their examples in times of uncertainty. Bowman and Deal add, stories grant comfort, reassurance, direction, and hope to people of all ages. Among those separatists who migrated to the Netherlands was a small congregation led by John Smythe and Thomas Helwys. As this particular group of separatists delved deeper into Scripture, they became convinced that the New Testament advocated believers' baptism rather than the infant baptism practiced by the established state churches, as well as both the Puritan and separatist congregations in England and the Netherlands. In 1609, this small group took the momentous step of embracing believers' baptism. Smythe first baptized himself, and then he baptized the others. In less than a year, Smythe regretted his self-baptism. Imagine that. And he insisted that these first Baptists should have received their baptism at the hands of the Mennonites who resided nearby. This decision ultimately caused a break between Smyth and his followers and Helwys, Thomas Helwys, and those who agreed with Helwys. Smyth died from consumption before he formally became a Mennonite, although some of his followers did embrace the Mennonites, who accepted them into their fellowship. Helwys and the handful of Baptists who agreed with Helwys' position used this occasion to return to England, despite the fact that they knew they faced intense persecution. Indeed, Helwys believed that it had been wrong for them to leave in the first place, to flee persecution in the first place. When they returned, they founded the first Baptist church in England at Spitalfield, an area of London. Almost immediately after his return, Helwys wrote the first Baptist treatise on religious liberty, titled, and this is the short title, A Short Declaration of the Mystery of Iniquity. This document boldly proclaimed that neither King James I of the King James Version of the Bible, authorized version of the Bible, nor for that matter any earthly ruler could dictate in matters of conscience. Helwys went further to add, and these are his words, let them be heretics, Turks, Jews, or whatsoever, it appertains not to the earthly power to punish them in the least measure. Helwys added fuel to the fire by sending the king a copy of the book with a personal note to King James inside the cover. Shortly thereafter, as you would expect, English authorities arrested him and threw him into prison, where he died about 2 years later. The Smyth-Helwys congregation established several cardinal Baptist principles. They practiced believers' baptism. They ardently defended religious liberty, and they courageously braved persecution for their faith. Despite this persecution, they also intensely evangelized and spread their beliefs. Within 12 years of their return to England, they had established four other Baptist churches, and by 1650, there were at least 47 of these Baptist churches in England. As this specific branch of Baptists, ultimately called General Baptists, formed and grew, another group of Baptists emerged in England. Like the General Baptists, these Baptists also emerged out of the separatist movement in England. However, unlike the General Baptists, who abandoned Calvinism of both Puritans and separatists, this new branch of Baptists retained the basic theology of their Puritan forebears and remained more connected with them during the English Civil War. They came to be known as particular Baptists due to their insistence that Christ's atonement was limited to the particular or the elect, unlike the General Baptist of the Helwys congregation, who believed that atonement was general. These particular Baptists broke away from the separatists of London probably by 1638, and by 1644, these particular Baptists issued their first confession of faith, seven of them. Much in the same way that the General Baptists contributed to Baptist history, the reclaiming of believers' baptism and the earliest treatises on religious liberty in Baptist history, the particular Baptists also made their own contribution to Baptist and Christian life. Particular Baptists were the first Baptists to recapture believers' baptism by immersion as the New Testament mode of baptism. Prior to this time, the General Baptists had most likely practiced baptism by pouring. Also, following in the footsteps of the Protestant reformers and their emphasis on Scripture, particular Baptists, if possible, placed even greater emphasis on scriptural authority for their churches. Baptist confessions stressed the authority of Scripture over man-made traditions, creeds, and edicts. The emphasis upon scriptural authority has continued to be a cornerstone of Baptist thought throughout four centuries of Baptist life. The emphasis on Scripture led to a key principle rooted deeply in the Baptist consciousness, the Baptist character, that of freedom of conscience. Baptists have historically believed
that each believer has the freedom of conscience to interpret the Bible on his or her own and to follow that interpretation of Scripture within the dictates of conscience. That freedom of conscience is to be tempered by active involvement in a local church congregation and within the broad boundaries of agreement to a confession of faith. Freedom of conscience and scriptural authority are closely aligned with the belief in religious liberty and separation of church and state. About the same time that English Baptists were beginning to consider baptism by immersion and issued their first major confession of faith, the first Baptists in America began to emerge. Like their English sisters and brothers, they also developed out of Puritanism and separatism. Roger Williams, who fled England due to religious persecution, migrated to Massachusetts. Already a committed separatist, Williams quickly angered the Puritan powers in Massachusetts, advancing radical ideas such as the necessity of complete separation from the Church of England, separation of church and state, religious liberty for everyone, the practice of political democracy, and the especially radical concept, and I think this is the one that really got him in trouble, that the Native Americans should be compensated for their land. The Puritans exiled Williams from Massachusetts in the dead of winter, but Williams was rescued by the Native Americans he had befriended and for whom he had served as an advocate. He probably would have perished if it had not been for them. With the help of friends, Williams purchased land from the Native Americans and established a new colony that eventually became Rhode Island. Roger Williams managed to implement full religious liberty and separation of church and state, which extended even to those with whom he strongly disagreed, such as the Quakers. He also served as one of the earliest Protestant missionaries to Native Americans in North America. One of the earliest actions that Williams took after his exile was to be part of the creation of the First Baptist Church in America. While Williams left his Baptist faith behind and became a seeker only a short time later, he continued to defend religious liberty and freedom of conscience. In this endeavor, he partnered with an even more important colonial Baptist leader, also an early resident of Rhode Island, John Clark. Clark's pilgrimage to Baptist life was similar to that of Williams, but unlike Williams, Clark remained a Baptist for the rest of his life. In many ways, Smythe and Williams were considerably alike, dynamic and creative figures willing to take on the establishment and attack conventional ideas, always intellectually and spiritually on the move. What I tell my students is you go inside a restroom, a tall restroom, remove all the things inside it, put a golf ball on the floor and hit a golf ball full swing. That gives you an image of Williams and Smythe and their mindset. Clark was more like Helwys. Clark was a builder. This was not to say that Clark compromised his values. Rather, Clark held steadfastly to his Baptist convictions at the same time as he defended many of the groundbreaking concepts that Williams also advocated. Clark's work, Ill News from New England, became one of the earliest writings in American history to advocate religious liberty. The only that really precedes it is Williams' own work. Religious liberty has continued to be one of the foundational ideas of Baptists throughout the centuries. Baptists in colonial America remained a relatively small and oppressed group throughout the first century of colonial life. However, in the 18th century, while the Great Awakening did not originate in Baptist life, no denomination benefited more from the revivals that spread throughout the colonies in these decades. Two men touched by the awakening, Isaac Backus and John Leland, became two of the most important Baptist leaders of the 18th and early 19th centuries, and are best known for being two of the leading Baptist advocates for religious liberty and separation of church and state during the Revolutionary and early Republic era. In the 20th century, Baptist leaders like Edgar Young Mullins and George W. Truett and the British Baptist Harry Rushbrook carried the mantle of religious liberty. And by the way, I'll just say, Rushbrook is very quickly becoming one of my favorite Baptists. I would encourage you to find out more about him. Really an amazing man. These individuals who were contemporaries, let me take this to the next slide. Three individuals who were contemporaries of Backus and Leland, Schubel Stearns, Daniel Marshall, and Martha Stearns Marshall, became Baptist foremost evangelists and church planters in the wake of the Great Awakening. By the way, Schubel was a great preacher. Daniel was considered rather dry. But Martha, Schubel's sister and Daniel's wife, they said was really a fireball in the pulpit. Due to people like Backus, Leland, Stearns, and the Marshalls, Baptists literally exploded with growth in America during the colonial period. The influence of the Great Awakening and its aftermath also demonstrate another key contribution to the cause of Christ, that of intense evangelism. Baptists, despite their roots lying in the flood soil of heavy persecution, they have consistently been a people deeply devoted to sharing their faith with others. This passion for sharing the gospel also translated into another contribution to Baptist Christianity, that of Baptist fervent support of missions. Baptist intense evangelism manifested itself in what might be called home missions in the years during and after the American Revolution. Former slave preacher David George carried Baptist mission to Nova Scotia. Later, George founded the nation of Sierra Leone, and planted the first Baptist church in West Africa there in 1793. The best known and perhaps most important pioneers in the modern missions movement were British Baptist Andrew Fuller and legendary William Carey. Rejecting the hyper-Calvinism of British Baptists in the late 18th century, and moved by the evangelical awakenings taking place in Britain and America, Fuller, Carey, and other Baptist pastors in Britain formed the Baptist Missionary Society and commissioned Carey to go to India. Carey challenged British Baptists with what has been called the Deathless Sermon. In this sermon, one of the things that Carey said was, "Expect great things from God, attempt great things for God." By the way, when he went to India, it was 7 years before he had his first convert. In those 7 years, his wife, Dorothy, who never wanted to go to the mission field in the first place, but went anyway, suffered a nervous breakdown and was essentially an invalid the remainder of her life. Leon Macbeth said that there should be a special memorial to Dorothy Carey, who never really understood what it was all about, and yet went anyway. Fuller, the theological support system and the financial support system for Carey, promised in a metaphor familiar to those in the surrounding mining country where they were from. He said, "If you will go into the mine, I will hold the rope." I should add that as he held the rope in his 62 years, he greatly destroyed his health. In the last month before he died, he traveled in those early 19th century years, more than 600 miles in a month, obviously on horseback, much of that, basically destroying his health. And during that same time period, his and his wife's, one of their sons, became estranged from the family. He joined the Navy and rejected Christianity, breaking Andrew Fuller's heart. And yet Fuller persevered and died in 1815, literally holding the rope of support for William Carey. Fuller's great sacrifice in devoting himself and supporting Carey's work in India, and Carey's persistent efforts radically to transform the Baptist vision into one that became truly worldwide. Subsequently, in America, Ann and Adoniram Judson and Judson's second and third wives, ladies, it was really hard on women on the in the mission field in those days, as well as other places. There's Ann, and there's his second wife, Sarah, and his third wife, Emily. Ann and Adoniram and Sarah and Emily felt compelled to begin their own mission endeavors that ultimately led to Baptists in America being equally committed to cooperative efforts to send missionaries worldwide. Not only did the General Missionary Conference in America support the Judsons' work in Burma, but they also undergirded the work of Gerhard Onken, whom Baptists ultimately labeled the father of Continental Baptists. Onken preached the motto, "Every member a missionary," which led the creation of numerous Baptist churches throughout Europe. Cooperative support of missions ultimately became one of the pillars of Baptist life. In the years that followed, Baptist giants like Black Baptist pioneer missionary to Liberia, Lot Carey, the legendary missionary to China, Lottie Moon, and AFBC and Auburn University's own I.T. Tischner, the father of cooperative missions, each laid foundations of Baptist work that persists today. In addition to intense evangelism, fervent support for missions, and the tradition of the Reformation, Baptists have also deposited their own contributions to great preaching from the days of the great evangelical revival in the 18th century and the preaching of Dan Taylor, to the Prince of Preachers of the 19th century, Charles Spurgeon, to the more recent days and the preaching of the somewhat recently deceased great African-American Baptist pastor, Gardner Taylor. A third major area of Baptist contributions would be in education and theology. Rooted in Baptist belief and freedom of conscience has been a deep Baptist commitment to education. Though some Baptists have been suspicious of too much education as a damper on zealous evangelism, or they've been suspicious of higher education because of its associations with the established church in England or the Puritan New England, many Baptists also recognized the need of cooperative support of higher education. This was especially true in England and in the colonies prior to the creation of the United States. Institutions of higher education forbade dissenters from matriculating, or as Leon Macbeth writes, Baptists faced harassment and second-class treatment of these at these schools, or many were proselytized to the state religion before graduation. Because of this, Baptists responded in various ways. One way they responded was to develop informal networks of education and discipleship. One of those who contributed theology, mentoring, and discipleship was Ann Dutton. Recognizing that some men rejected women in a teaching or theological role, Dutton chose to remove her name from many of her publications. Despite this bias, many men accepted the spiritual guidance, sound theology, and mystical experimental faith, that experimental and experiential faith, Ann Dutton wrote and counseled. Ann Dutton was a 17th century Baptist mystic, you might say, in some ways. In her lifetime, Ann Dutton published dozens of works, wrote countless of letters that ultimately influenced Baptist spirituality and theology and encouraged Baptist embrace of the great evangelical revival of the 18th century. Baptists also found it imperative to begin institutions of higher education, especially for the intellectual development of Baptist ministers. In England, Baptists developed Bristol College, while in the colonies, Baptists in America founded Brown University. Baptist colleges, universities, divinity schools, seminaries have made a substantial contribution to higher education, not only for Baptists, but also for generations of students who have served in a multitude of capacities beyond that of just serving as ministers and missionaries. Further representative of this contribution of Baptist theology would be two of Baptist's foremost theologians, both arising in Baptist life in the 20th century, the aforementioned E.Y. Mullins, and also Mark Wilson's favorite, W.O. Carver. And he could tell you more about Carver than I ever could. I will add this for those of you who knew John Jeffers. in the early 2000s, John and I were corresponding, and he said he preferred to be known as a Mullen and Carver Baptist. I knew you would appreciate that. A final area is pastoral ministry, ethics, and social justice. Yet another contribution of Baptist Christian Heritage would be that of social justice, ethics, pastoral ministry. One of the greatest early pastors, Benjamin Keach, became Baptist's first great musician. At a time when most Baptists and others from the Reformed tradition rejected singing other than that of the Psalms in their worship service, with the sensitivity of a great theologian and musician, Keach pushed Baptists to embrace hymn singing and hence contributed mightily to Baptist life, but also to Baptist theology and to Christian heritage, as passionate Baptist music became one of the key marks of Baptist life and it played a key role in pastoral ministry in the church. Likewise, Ann Dutton, through her ministry, essentially functioned as a pastor for those to whom she counseled. Also rooted in the Baptist belief, freedom of conscience has been a Baptist advocacy for social justice. Unfortunately, not all Baptists have held to the importance of speaking out for the oppressed. Despite the fact that early Baptist history was filled with oppression and the fact that early Baptists were most numerous among the lower middle class, the poor, and the outcast, Baptists have sometimes been guilty of ignoring oppression or the oppressor, or being the oppressor sometimes. One of the dark stains on Baptist life has been the fact that many Baptists defended slavery and segregation or failed to speak out on behalf of the poor, the oppressed, the immigrant, the least of these among us. There have also been many Baptists, however, who spoke prophetically and worked to minister on the behalf of those who have been downtrodden. In Great Britain, Abraham Booth preached against slavery and the slave trade. At the same time, William Wilberforce, much better known, was doing so. And the British Baptist missionary, the amazing British Baptist missionary to Jamaica, William Nibb, led the fight to end slavery in the British Empire and dramatically defended rights of blacks in England as well. In the United States, abolitionist Baptists formed the American Baptist Anti-Slavery Convention in 1840, and many Baptists in the North became active proponents of immediate abolition in the American South. Unfortunately, as many of you would know, all of you perhaps know, slavery played a key role in the development of the Southern Baptist Convention in 1845, and in an example of cultural captivity, most of the greatest Southern Baptist leaders supported slavery, and most Southern Baptists sided with the South when 11 states seceded and brought on the American Civil War. Baptist fight for social justice did not end with the Civil War and the abolition of slavery, especially as Northern Baptists faced the problems of massive immigration and rapid urbanization, along with a rapidly changing society. Baptists in America turned their faces toward ministering to the poor in both urban settings of the East and the rural poverty of the mountains and of the West. Baptist pastor and seminary professor Walter Rauschenbusch began his ministry in such a bad portion of New York City that New Yorkers labeled it Hell's Kitchen. Rauschenbusch's experiences there led him to become a leader of the social gospel movement and write his momentous book, Christianity and the Social Crisis. Glenn Henson describes Walter Rauschenbusch's ideas in Christianity and the Social Crisis as a threefold argument. Rauschenbusch argued that to serve Christ, Christians must try to construct a social order in which kingdom ways will prevail. He also argued that both the world and the church would benefit significantly from the recovery of Christianity's social mission. It might prevent the collapse of Western civilization, such as befell the Roman Empire. Finally, Rauschenbusch hoped to persuade aroused Christians that hope lay at hand for corrective action. Rauschenbusch believed that the most important corrective is the spiritual regeneration that awakens individuals to their complicity in the sins of society and leads them to commit themselves to social reform. That's the end of the quotation from Henson. This advocacy for social justice became a key component of Northern Baptist life in the early part of the century, led in part by the efforts of Helen Barrett Montgomery. Montgomery also served as a key voice in seeking social justice for women, as well as a role for women in denominational leadership. While some Baptists rejected portions of the theology that surrounded the social gospel movement as being liberal, there were other Baptists who embraced the cardinal elements of the movement without adopting all of its theology. Among Southern Baptists, Texas Baptist leader Robert Cook Buckner pioneered work among the poor, especially with regards to care for orphans. Others, like Annie Armstrong and Fanny Heck, utilized the work of Women's Missionary Union to promote not only cooperative mission support for both foreign and home missions, but also to reach out to the poor. Some writers have labeled this more conservative brand of social justice advocacy as social Christianity, distinguish it from social gospel. Arising from the oppression of slavery and segregation in the American South, American Baptists have long been the advocates of social justice. Pioneering Black Baptist leaders such as E.C. Morris and Nannie Helen Burroughs not only engaged in raising awareness of cooperative mission support in the newly created National Baptist Convention, but also social justice issues. Burroughs, for example, scolded Black ministers, and these are her words, for preaching too much heaven and too little practical Christian living, and called on them to make their religion a real potent factor in race regeneration. Burroughs also spoke to white Christians and chastised them for not welcoming all people. The prophetic Burroughs wrote, and these are her words again, "It is high time that the church were up to its business, or it should stop preaching, stop building churches of Christ while excluding races that are not of the color that they like. Stop teaching spurious doctrines and wearing the livery of heaven in which to masquerade and naming the name of Jesus and refuse to follow his teachings." Deep breath there. Finally, we should mention two latter-day prophets of Baptist life, T.B. Maston and Henley Barnett, who spoke in gentle yet firm tones in favor of multifaceted social justice. Both men advocated for the least of these. So, who are Baptists? And how have we contributed to the cause of Christ? My presentation has identified some of the key individuals and ideas of Baptists across more than 400 years of Baptist history. Despite many times experiencing widespread persecution, both in the past and even today in other parts of the world, Baptists have continued to emphasize religious liberty, intense evangelism, fervent support of missions, fervent cooperative support of missions in higher education, warm preaching and pastoral ministry, and prophetic social justice, built upon scriptural authority and freedom of conscience within the boundaries of a community of believers. While some of these concepts are not exclusive to Baptists, together they form the deposits that Baptists have made to the Reformation River, to Baptist life, and to the cause of Christ in the world. There are those who argue convincingly that we are living in a post-denominational culture, especially in the United States. Perhaps that's so. Certainly Christianity would benefit from a more Irenic and ecumenical spirit. However, there is also still place for Baptists who are willing to embrace the positive facets of our heritage, as well as acknowledge the more negative aspects. Perhaps more evangelistic Baptists would do well to study more carefully our social justice tradition. Perhaps those who identify more with religious freedom and freedom of conscience would do well to be reminded of our powerful past of preaching, or the zeal of evangelism and Baptist missions. And Christians and non-Christians, conservative, liberal, progressive, centrist, people religious or secularist, American people or international people, would do well to know that being a Baptist Christian does not mean that all Baptist Christians are alike. being a Baptist Christian should mean that we may not agree on everything, except to agree that we will love rather than to hate, and that we will embrace both faith, we will embrace our faith more than our fear. As Baptist Christians seek to minister in the midst of a changing world, the world continues to need the prophetic voice that Baptists can offer. Proverbs 29:18 says, "Where there is no prophecy, the people cast off restraint." In God's Politics, Jim Wallace writes, "Perhaps that prophetic insight explains why a lack of vision in a society contributes directly to social unrest, lawlessness, violence, and chaos. It may not be poverty, and I would add, or racism, war, religious extremism, that leads to social breakdown, but also the absence of any compelling and credible vision articulated by public leaders and accepted by the people that serves to hold society together." And that's the end of the Wallace quote. Baptists need more than ever to articulate that vision, but Baptists must do so recognizing all aspects of our heritage, not just those that fit our personal profile or our church's personality profile. We can only do that by continuing to search, study, and teach Baptist history within the context of Christian, American, and world history. Thank you, and if you turn on the lights, we'll have a few minutes for questions and discussion. Thank you.